Hello, I'm Al Rasmussen for the Missing People podcast. This program is a continuation of Kelly Jolkowski's series, Psychics and Missing People. The story continues.
Dawn has told us that at the time of this conversation, she believed in the ability of psychics. After this experience, as with so many psychic predator victims, that is no longer the case.
The following is an audio representation of a text communication between Dawn and Lori.
Felonia. Hi, this is Dawn. Would you rather I call so we can talk about Lori? My number is 555-4321. And yes, I was the one on the phone the other day when you came to Jenny's.
I have to wait till my daughter gets back so I can go to the phone. Mine is off. Cool, I've been trying to reach her. There is more to this thing, and I was hoping it would help.
I forwarded a letter to Jenny and to Investigator Wade. I called him the night you came over. They did look into the cabin, as I'm sure you read on the website. They came up empty-handed, I guess.
Have they looked in the inlet?
I don't know.
They need to.
I can ask him tomorrow. I have gotten two calls this week about Lori from people that at one time saw visions and now the visions are gone, indicating that she had died recently. Are you getting the same thing?
There is a boat launch inlet, and from that boat launch, look across, there is a camp. Need to check it. And I have to say, Belle said that too, that she is gone and that he moved her. She said she is in a field, not a lot of trees, just tall grass and brush.
On the side of the road?
I will have to tell you in person what happened to my friend Linda. She doesn't know Lori, only that I know her, and I'm very upset about her being gone. Yeah. Did you guys call Belle? I want to ask you something.
I don't know if Jenny did. I think she might have. Yes?
The person of interest's name is Sean, right?
Yes. I posted it on the website last week. Our media won't say his name, but it has been all over the news in Hudson Falls. I know Sean very well.
Okay, I want to describe him to you from what I have been told by my friend Linda, okay? Tell me if I'm right.
I can tell you a lot about him. Okay.
He is tall, dark hair, kind of short in the back, a little long in the front. Dark eyes, muscular, has a little scary look to him.
No.
Okay. How close am I?
I'm 5'4", and he is definitely taller than I am, but he isn't huge. Last time I saw him, his hair was really short all over, but that could have changed. He actually looks like kind of a dork to me. He does have tattoos all over his arms. Wears glasses.
There are two people involved. Sean took her there and came back, and someone else was there.
Just so you know, there is no way that Sean has been with her since the beginning. They are watching him like a hawk.
Well, Linda said he was tall, medium build, dark hair. Hair was short, but like he had some bangs.
Sean is very skinny.
Right, but what they said was he took her there and then he came back. Okay.
Did you read all the info on him we posted on the website about how he tried to kill a woman before?
Oh, that makes it worse. Yes. Why was he able to do this? I can't believe he only got probation.
The girl's mother saved her from him. He was choking her and had her tied up.
Dawn, I will tell you what else Linda seen, kay?
Okay.
She said this camp I'm talking about in the inlet, she went in there in her vision. This house is yellow with burgundy trim. When you walk in, there's a small kitchen. She's seen an old man with gray hair, tall, hefty glasses, wearing belted pants, shirt tucked in. There was a frail old lady sitting in a brown leather recliner, and she tried to say something to us, but the old man told her to shut up.
Would that indicate that the people in the cabin were deceased, the old man and women?
The living room was light blue. Carpet was dark blue. The curtains were green-blue with white scrolls behind the recliner. There was an attic door with curtain covering them. No, I think it's his grandparents, and they're covering for him.
Okay, I get it.
Linda said she was scared of the old man and the other man in the attic. Then Linda pulled down the curtains and opened the door. This is where it gets really scary. When she opened the door, she seen at the top of the stairs a tall guy sweating. Medium build, dark hair, eyes are glossy. Dark blue tank top, jeans. Linda sees Lori looking like she's hanging, white blanket all around her in ropes.
What does she think the guy is doing?
There was a struggle and he ran off with her, and she can't see where he went with her.
A struggle with Lori?
Oh, I forgot this. I'm reading what she wrote from a paper. It's all out of order, because when she was writing this, she was like rocking and she couldn't breathe. She said it was so real. When she walked in the house, she seen Lori hanging in a blanket, and that's when the old lady tried to speak and couldn't, and then it went on from there. Now, we went back down to the kitchen. There was an old porcelain sink, and Lori was standing next to the sink. The struggle was with us. We tried to get her. She walked up to us and said, "I'm okay. I'm really okay." The man is standing next to her, glaring. She was made to say it.
She was standing next to the sink after she was wrapped up in the blanket?
And we walked outside. The driveway was paved with tall pine edging the driveway. Yes, Linda said that she was like saying, "I'm okay now," because Linda said that she has passed.
Does that mean that the man has passed too if he was there glaring at her?
I wish I could have Linda talk to you. Linda was crying when she told me this. No, the man was glaring at us. You know, I will ask Linda about that.
Okay.
But Linda doesn't even know Lori. I asked her what the girl looked like and she said blonde hair, blue eyes. But Lori has green. Very thin, pretty. Did she wear contacts? In the picture I have, her eyes are like very green, and I didn't know if she wore color contacts.
No, Lori does not have contacts, and at the time she went missing, she had brown hair.
Linda had a lot of weird colors in her vision, and she even said she's not sure what they mean.
My 13-year-old daughter just said that the one thing she remembers about Sean is that he had piercing blue eyes.
Was he from around here? I know his family is from up there, but did he live here? How did Lori get involved with this guy?
She met him on the internet. His entire family is from that area.
I want to go up there myself and look to see if her vision is true. With the camp up there, she said that the camp is lived in all year round.
Might not be safe. I wouldn't suggest doing that if I were you.
Linda seems to think that she's in the area near Cascade Lake and Shallow Lake, like somewhere in that area. I would go to the house. I want to see if everything is like what she said.
Good. I just wish we could find her. I feel like we are all in limbo and no one really seems to know what to do at this point.
What is your number again? I'm going to go over to Linda's and call you. There are more details that isn't on the paper. If you want me to, she said it was like she was there. If you heard it, it's different than what I just typed to you. There's more to it.
Okay. Call me 555-4321.
I know I'm pulling at straws. It will lead to her. God, it hurts me. And can't even imagine what you guys are going through. Hoping? Okay, I'll give you a call in a bit. Will you be up for a little while?
Yeah, I will be up till at least 11.
I have to see if Linda is home. If not, I'll come back. And thanks for listening. I hope something will help. Okay.
Thank you for contacting us. We appreciate anything you can give us at this point. I am going to call Jenny and let her know I talked to you.
Okay, I'm going to Linda's. I'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
She never called Dawn back, and every attempt that was made to contact her was ignored. Lori was found 14 days after this discussion. Rebecca Howard, aunt of Tamika Houston, provided the following contribution under the title of Holding Hope in Their Hands.
My niece, Tamika Antoinette Houston, disappeared on May 27, 2004. We learned on August 12, 2005, that she had been callously murdered and buried in the remote woods of upstate South Carolina on the very day she disappeared by a new acquaintance named Christopher Lamont Hampton. We searched for Tamika far and wide for those 13.5 months. Our hearts were broken, and we considered no means too silly or too unproven in order to bring our beloved Tamika back home to us. Internet postings, mass distribution of emails, flyer postings, canine searches, canvassing neighborhoods, local and national media, outreach, and yes, even psychics. We did not search out our first encounter with a self-proclaimed psychic. Within weeks of Tamika's disappearance, I appeared on a local radio show that aired in New York City in order to discuss the case and the disproportionate amount of media coverage given to cases involving missing minorities. Within a day or two, I was contacted by a well-meaning woman who wanted to put me in touch with her friend, a man named Jerome Carter. She said Jerome had worked on numerous missing person cases, and she was hopeful he could help us find Tamika. Before I go further, let me first divulge that I am not skeptical by nature of those claiming to have some sort of psychic ability or higher developed sixth sense. Tamika herself often astounded me, our family and friends, with her ability to know certain things about a person she had no reason to know. She had these abilities even as a child, but didn't think much about it. It was just her. She didn't try to profit from it as she got older or exploit it. It was just another personality trait, and that, frankly, may have even scared her a little as she got older. I'm told by her best friend that Tamika even predicted her own untimely death years and months before, and even the very week of her disappearance. She knew she was going to die young. I wish she had told me, too. So with that background, I picked up the phone in desperation and called Mr. Carter. We spoke for a few minutes, and he said he had a strong sense Tamika was still alive. Of course, my heart was overjoyed. I called family, including my sister and Tamika's distraught mother, and told them we must take what Carter is saying with a grain of salt, but that I would continue to speak with him in the hopes of determining Tamika's location. Carter told me he would work with us for the bargain price of $500 if I could wire him the money via Western Union. Carter told me he would work with us for the bargain basement price of $500 if I could wire him the money via Western Union. I left my office, withdrew the money from an ATM, and headed over to the closest Western Union location I could find. I was also to fax him a photograph of Tamika to the luxury hotel where he was staying at the time. Upon receipt of the money and photo, Carter was to call me that night and conduct a session. Over the course of about 1 week, I spoke with Carter 3 or 4 times. Each time, his descriptions of Tamika's location and the circumstances surrounding her disappearance became more specific. She had voluntarily attended a party in town near where she lived, but now was being held against her will. She was being drugged. She would appear unrecognizable to us when we finally found her, because she had lost so much weight. She was allowed to leave the house once a day with one of her captors. The house had a bird, maybe on the mailbox, a burgundy car in the driveway. Carter named street locations and the town. Worst of all, he promised this whole nightmare would wrap up in about a week with the safe return home of our Tamika. I sent Tamika's father on a wild goose chase for 2 or 3 nights to the locations Carter described. I even enlisted the sympathetic investigator working on Tamika's case to follow up on these unconventional clues. I later would express my frustration to Carter, who eventually offered to fly to South Carolina and look for Tamika himself, provided I could Western Union him another $500 right away and purchase him a plane ticket. He seemed way too persistent and certainly too anxious. I withdrew and quickly realized I was probably being taken advantage of. I couldn't confirm Carter's claims that he had determined the location of Chandra Levy's remains, as he had said. Further, I was warned by a friend who was a producer of a nationally syndicated radio program that Carter had appeared on their program many times. This friend said Carter had led a distraught mother to believe for months that her missing daughter was alive when, in fact, she had been dead for some time. That was it for me. I cut off communications with Carter and kept pursuing other means in order to find Tamika. It would be months later before the issue of psychics came up again. My sister, Tamika's mother, was at her breaking point. Actually, she had probably been broken for months. She asked me if she could look into finding and utilizing a more reputable psychic. I told her I would conduct extensive research and try to find the right person. My research led me to Noreen Renier. I was impressed with her resume and the fact that she apparently had lectured at the FBI Academy in Quantico, Virginia. At this point, we were willing to try anything, again. Renier prefers to work with law enforcement only, which I felt increased her credibility. Surprisingly, the open-minded police investigators working on Tamika's case didn't laugh at my suggestion. Instead, they set up an appointment with Renier, at our family's expense, and drove from South Carolina to the hills of rural Virginia to meet with her. These officers would later describe this experience as probably one of the strangest they've encountered in all their years of law enforcement, but I was grateful for their efforts. Renier described a much different scene than Carter had. Tamika was deceased. She had been killed by a blunt object at the hands of someone she knew. She had been wrapped up and driven around in a vehicle before being disposed of in a remote area, down a dirt and gravel road, near water, near an embankment. Renier said it wasn't far from where Tamika had lived. Unfortunately, these clues were like looking for a needle in a haystack. The police followed up on these clues, along with others provided by Renier, to no avail. It wasn't until weeks later, when they arrested their prime suspect, Hampton, that he led them to Tamika's shallow grave in the woods. In the end, Renier's clues did little more than to provide us and law enforcement with moments of surprise after the fact. Unfortunately, what she saw was not specific enough to lead police to the location of Tamika's body. The killer had to do that himself. If I had to do it again, I probably wouldn't enlist her services or the services of another psychic. Good old police work is what solves crimes.
For more information about Tamika Houston's story, please go to the website tamikahouston.com. That's spelled TAMIKAHUSTON.com.
Colleen Nick has over 10 years of experience in working with families of the missing through the organization she founded, the Morgan Nick Foundation. With her guidance, the MNF has assisted well over 3,000 families of missing persons. They have been instrumental in passing legislation and have provided over 200,000 photo IDs for children in Arkansas. Colleen also has intimate knowledge of missing persons issues. Her daughter Morgan was kidnapped at the age of 6 and has been missing for almost 11 years.
I'm not in favor of seeking out psychic assistance. Unfortunately, not being willing to utilize psychics pushes a family into the discussion about doing everything possible to find their missing child, and the gut-wrenching guilt that if you don't take this route, you have not done everything. The pressure that is exerted to seek out psychics can be overwhelming to parents who are deeply in pain and already racked with guilt over the child being missing. I believe you can do everything possible to search for a missing loved one without soliciting psychic help. My opinion and experience are that utilizing a psychic is exploitive to the family, is often emotionally damaging, and can be financially taxing. And sometimes psychics want belongings of the missing loved ones, treasures, that are never returned. These types of devastating blows continue to re-victimize a family that is already reeling. When psychics call in leads on a missing person case, the leads should absolutely be followed, just like any other lead. There have been instances in ongoing cases where someone wanted to confess their crime against a victim, and the criminal called the police, claiming to have psychic information about the crime. I believe today that if Morgan were found in a purple minivan with pink polka dots driven by yellow gorillas, we would have a psychic step forward who would claim to have given that information in the past. We have had somewhere over 500 leads from psychics. On a personal level, due to my deep faith and my firm conviction in the Word of God, I have stayed far, far away from psychics.
My note, over 500 psychics, and none have been right. Doesn't that tell you something?
For additional information about the Morgan Nick Foundation, please go to the website morgannick.com. That's morgannick.com.
Mark Kloss's life changed in the blink of an eye when his 12-year-old daughter, Polly, was kidnapped and murdered. In the aftermath, he became dedicated to making a safer life for the nation's children through education, legislation, and the work of the Kloss Kids Foundation. Mark supports us in our efforts to make families and the general public aware of the harm caused by psychics. He gave us permission to use his article.
Psychic detectives are the vanguard of a second wave of predators that also includes tabloid journalists, cheesy defense lawyers, and photo op politicians. They use tabloid newspapers and talk shows to boast about their accomplishments and predict success. They materialize whenever children are kidnapped and circle the cases like vultures on a fresh carcass. They scan the media for the haunting eyes of desperate parents willing to do anything to recover their children, and then they show up on your doorstep, literally or figuratively, to make the pitch. They claim to be on the cutting edge of communications, able to predict future events and reach into heaven and hell with their mind. They hold your hand, massage your psyche, and convince you that the only thing separating you from their extraordinary gift is your money. However, some simply require airfare and living expenses, what we call a vacation. They seem to answer the prayer that ends the nightmare, but only if you can afford the ticket. Frantic parents will do anything, and they offer something, which is better than nothing. Few of us possess the resources to underwrite crisis, let alone psychic detectives, so they should be reminded that a substantial reward awaits whoever solves the case and returns the stolen child. Although that strategy eliminates most psychics, some maintain a foothold by appealing to superstitiously vulnerable family members. They make provocative predictions. In California, rolling hills, a road or highway, perhaps a building or a bubbling brook. In Arizona, sand dunes replacing rolling hills and cactus substitutes the bubbling brook. In other words, they describe 95% of the geography of the western United States. Psychic detectives do not possess supernatural insight. They do not converse with the missing or the dead. They never bring children home. However, their rambling predictions may have filled in enough gaps to pad their resumes and claim the reward. A few months after Polly was recovered, a psychic claimed that she solved Polly's case on the television program Hard Copy. Not only was she using my daughter's death to promote herself, but she also dismissed all of the wonderful people, police, media, and volunteers who worked so hard and tirelessly to locate my child. In truth, that psychic detective's contribution to the case was counterproductive. As always seems to be the case with psychic predictions, her interference created distraction. Law enforcement resources are diverted toward useless endeavors as phantom leads disappear into thin air. One cold and dark November evening, many of us were lurking around somebody's property because the psychic said that it held the key to my daughter's disappearance. With the heightened sense of paranoia that already existed in the community, that property owner would have been well within his rights to blow us away on the spot for trespassing. We were very fortunate that night, because although he did angrily confront us, he had absolutely nothing to do with the crime we were investigating. In the end, and despite their protests, there is not even one case of a psychic truly assisting or solving a missing child case. It's just smoke and mirrors. Their references do not support their claims, and law enforcement cannot acknowledge their existence. Instead, their wishful thinking collides with your desperate hope and leaves you diminished. Unfortunately, the next time a little child is kidnapped and mom and dad reach the end of their emotional string, the vague, empty promises of the psychic detective will rebound off the stark walls of the missing child's bedroom, and a photo or toy will be palmed as the negotiations are engaged. It is inevitable. I predict it. To learn more about the Class Kids Foundation, go to classkids.org, spelled KLAASKIDS.org. This has been a Missing People podcast production of Kelly Jolkowski's Psychics and Missing People, in association with ProjectJason.org. Participating voice talents were Sue Rasmussen as Kelly Jolkowski, Gene Levins, and me, Al Rasmussen. Audio adaptation by David Anderson, produced and directed by Steve Branham. Original music created and performed by Ariana Kima. Copyright 2006-2007, all rights reserved, jointly by the Missing People Podcast and Project Jason. For more information about Project Jason, please go to projectjason.org. For my co-hosts, Kelly Jolkowski and Steve Branham, I'm Al Rasmussen with the Missing People Podcast. Thank you for listening.